Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to this morning's study session for the Mesa City Council, Thursday, June 24th, 2010. Before we begin, we'd like to excuse Councilmember Summers, who's out of town. And while there is no excuse for Councilmember Richens, we'll at least dismiss him from the meeting. Councilmember Richens is representing the city at a Valley Forward meeting, and so he will not be with us this morning either. We'll begin the meeting by reviewing the agenda for next Thursday's City Council meeting. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Wow.
That was tough.
Yeah. Mr. Brady, anything you want to go over on this agenda? Or we pretty much have touched everything, haven't we? Okay. We'll move on to the next item. Hear a presentation and discuss form-based codes. Mr. Wesley, I'm assuming this is you.
I get to start the ball rolling just a little bit. Our consultant, Mr. Froelich, come on up. I'm going to introduce our consultant and then turn the presentation over to him. As you know, with the light rail coming and our work on the Central Maine plan, we've recognized that a form-based code option will be very beneficial to us for the downtown and light rail areas and maybe other areas of the city. So we have hired a consultant to help us add this component to our zoning ordinance. Introduced to you Mr. Dan Prolick of Opticoast Design from California. After a search for the best consultants to help us with this project, we focused on Opticoast Design. Mr. Prolick is a leader in the industry, has written the book on form-based codes that are used by everybody to learn and understand about form-based codes. He's been active in the urbanist movement and the form-based code movement for quite a long time, has a background in both large and small cities, understands how they work very well and the concepts of placemaking. And so with that, I'll introduce Dan. He's been here for one other trip, here to this now for a two-day workshop, and invite the council to participate in that. But Dan, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, John, and thank you, Mayor, and thank you, Council, for having me here this morning. It's a pleasure to be back in Mesa, and it's neat to be in a place that has such great charm in its downtown from an architecture and a placemaking standpoint, but also potential that's really quite tremendous. And so I'm glad to be part of a team that's here to help you harness that potential in terms of a long-term plan and the form-based code. And I want to give a presentation on form-based coding as a tool for placemaking, because I think if we talk about it simply as zoning, we kind of miss out on the fact that form-based coding is actually a really great tool for reinforcing the place you have and helping you create the place you want Mesa to be in the future. I just like to start off with this slide because it's, as you all know, I'm sure, it's not just us planners and designers that are talking about place, about form-based coding, but rather the developers are talking about this as well, which is really exciting at this point, and even the real estate industry. It's actually a slide that Rob Dixon, who's an Albuquerque developer, gave in a keynote presentation at the New Partners for Smart Growth Conference, where the title of his presentation was The Top 20 Ways to Make a Green Smart City. And I was obviously very pleasantly surprised to see number 2 on that list to replace Euclidean zoning with form-based coding. So it's great that in your zoning code update process, you're able to put a little placeholder in place for the form-based code component. And we're now ready to work with you and your staff and your community to fill in that gap within the zoning code. So I'm going to give a pretty brief presentation, about another 10 to 15 minutes. Touch upon these 4 points, which are just, I wanted to introduce our team. My team's all here behind me very quickly. I wanted to talk about some very basic principles of the approach that we're taking to this project, get some feedback from you, and then obviously a very brief introduction to form-based coding as we apply it and practice it, and then wanted to get some of your additional thoughts on some other items that typically will come up and need to be discussed as a form-based coding process gets implemented. So first of all, in terms of introducing the team, a little bit of comic relief. One of the interesting pieces of street artwork that you have in your downtown here. But I wanted to introduce our team in with the notion of a collaborative
artwork.
So
that was part of the planning staff. I'm sorry.
So I'm always pleasantly surprised and engaged by the artwork that you have on your main street as I walk up and down your main street, and always a little bit. I've taken a lot of pictures of it. So our team's really been put together, and all the projects like this are about collaboration with you as decision makers, but as well as your community and your staff. And we're very much about creating a collaborative effort in this process and looking forward to continuing to work with you all. So we're OptiCoast Design. We are the lead consultant and the primary contact for John and his staff. I just wanted to mention a couple of things. So we're nationally recognized for our form-based coding work, and we're really excited about it because we approach this zoning from a placemaking standpoint. And I think the thing that does differentiate us from most folks who are writing zoning codes or even form-based codes is we actually are architects and urban designers, and so we come at this from a slightly different direction in terms of design and the character and quality of place driving the process. And Christopher Jansen from our office, who's here in the audience, it will be our project manager. Chris, raise your hand. Another recent project. We just recently won an award for an infill green housing project in Santa Fe, New Mexico, a really great little courtyard housing project. Just wanted to give you a glimpse of kind of some of the things we've been up to. Lisa Wise Consulting, and Lisa Wise is in the audience as well. She's based out of San Luis Obispo, a planner. We're always thrilled to work with Lisa. We both have fairly small shops and like to collaborate. We've worked on our last three or four form-based codes together, so it's great to have Lisa on board. Billy Hadaway from VHB. He's our transportation consultant that's going to focus on thoroughfare design, which will be part of the form-based code. It's a little bit hard to see in this slide. Billy's actually in this fire truck. I'm not sure if he's driving it or just a passenger, but when Billy's dealing with public works directors and the fire department in terms of trying to create walkable communities, he's always up to the challenge of jumping in that fire truck and sort of illustrating that you can maneuver on these streets, these pedestrian-oriented streets that we're proposing and within walkable urban areas. We're thrilled to have Tiffany and Bosco out of Phoenix, land use attorneys. Both Dustin Jones and Shane Alleman are in the audience today to be a bit of a local presence here, as well as to just make sure that we're staying in line in terms of private property rights. And then lastly, we have Urban Advantage, which will be doing visual simulations at the next workshop. Steve Price is actually not here today, but will be at the second workshop. So just a couple of reinforcing principles of our approach, and feel free to comment on these later when I open it up to comments. Or even now if you'd like. But first of all, it's just, I think our approach is very much about reinforcing a unique character and quality of place. Every place that we go into, we do very thorough assessment and analysis of what it is that makes each place unique. They're there's aspects in terms of the urban pattern, the architecture, the landscape, that we want to reinforce as we're sort of helping refine the plan as well as writing the form-based code. And those unique elements are really reinforced within the form-based code. So I think one aspect of this that has came up yesterday in our stakeholder interviews is the historic preservation and what role that might play in the central main plan and form-based code. So then we obviously just needing to think about what currently defines Mesa. What do people think? You know, this is part of our stakeholder outreach in this public workshop process, or the desired new Mesa or the evolving Mesa as we move forward with the plan and the form-based code. I think the other notion that we're throwing out there is beginning to define downtown just as much as a neighborhood as it is a destination. And so that's a concept that we'll continuously bring up and reinforce is getting more people to live downtown, create a, I know you've talked about this a lot, a 24/7 vibrant environment in the downtown. It's something that we'll continue to discuss as this process evolves. Another principle is making transit transformative. And just making sure that a community such as Mesa really utilizes this potential as the light rail extends from the western edge of your town into the core of your downtown, and making sure you've got a framework in place for that, for the tools that will help in that transformation, and really utilizing it as an economic development tool. So this is, I just wanted to show a one series of slides from Steve Price and Urban Advantage. I'm not saying that this is the level of transformation that's going to happen, but just, you know, this was just a, for Chula Vista, California, a series of slides showing potential build out of a corridor in Chula Vista as the light rail extended through their downtown area. So Steve will be with us in our second workshop, working with you all in terms of scale of buildings, character buildings, and picking some sites to actually do some of these visual transformations. So I'm going to talk now about the form-based codes just for a brief minute and introduce some just general vocabulary so we can all speak the same language in terms of the form-based coding. And I think that we really, really see form-based coding as a tool for high-quality implementation. We've not only have we written form-based codes, but we've actually worked as contract staff, as town architects, to help administer form-based codes. We've been doing it for 8 years, both in Hercules, California, and in the Pleasant Hill with the Contra Costa County Redevelopment Agency. So we've seen it from the other side of the table of projects coming through and administering that code and ensuring predictable built results that the community supported in the public process. And so I think the most important aspect about a form-based code, instead of approaching the coding and the zoning from a use standpoint, it's really about taking a step back, thinking about the type of place that you're trying to create and the character of that place and the scale and what that place looks and feels like, and then using that as the framework for your code as you move forward. So and a lot of people misunderstand that form-based coding, it's not design guidelines, it is actually it's zoning, and it replaces the zones that currently exist. So it's really about regulating places and not uses. And as once we start generating drafts of the code, you'll see that the zones that we create, I mean, you know, you've actually, this was introduced a while back in your old zoning code, and it's part of that's some of it's come over into your new zoning code as well. But the zones will be based on that type, intended type of place, and not instead of the use. So I just wanted to show a couple of quick images. We're currently rewriting the city of Flagstaff's citywide zoning code with a form-based code framework. And on the left-hand side of my slide here is an image that we created of a generalized context of Flagstaff from the upper portion of the drawing, which is the most natural environment in the San Francisco Peaks, down to the lower portion of the drawing, which is the most urban area of the downtown, the core of downtown Flagstaff near the train station. And we often think about sort of as you move from this continuum from the natural to the urban, needing to think about each one of those places differently as we're writing code for that. And this is called the urban to rural transect. And it's likely a foundation for the decisions we'll be making for how we treat different areas. Your main street, how does it transition from main street into your historic neighborhoods, and then how are your historic neighborhoods treated? So we'll be thinking about it in that way. And as we go through this process a little bit further, we'll be taking this urban to rural transect and putting local photographs of Mesa into this diagram, so you begin to understand where your local places fit within this continuum. typical list of form-based code components. The regulating plan is a term we use for the zoning code that would, in this instance, the form-based zones will actually be on the same map as your conventional zones, and so they'll be sit side by side on your zoning plan. Building form standards, and I'm going to show you a glimpse of those, but that's really the core of the form-based code elements, where you're regulating height, setbacks, build to lines, parking location, thoroughfare standards. As I mentioned earlier, Billy Hadaway is going to be helping us with that. Because a form-based code is about creating this character and quality of the place, the street design and the design of that the thoroughfares becomes a really important component. Frontage types, building types, and civic space standards. So one of the real driving principles behind the form-based code is that they're very graphic and easy to use. So you'll notice as the drafts come out is that sort of paragraph after paragraph of text is replaced by very simple graphics and tables to be very clear about the intent of the actual regulations themselves. This is just a glimpse at similar. This is our typical format for building form standards to give you a sense of what you'll be expecting as the draft of the code is created. But you can see here a layout that's very much based on some very simple graphics and below it tables that will regulate the specific information within the code. A very simplified approach to land use tables to make sure that the uses aren't driving ultimately the form and intent, but rather being supportive or secondary to the building form and the character of the place. And then we often include one illustrative drawing on the last page to just reinforce the intent of that particular zone. So just as a summary, as a little bit of comic relief, but also just I think people tend to remember this slide of Mr. Potato Head. One of our clients actually gave us this. It was Mr. Potato Head. So on the left-hand side, the form-based coding in terms of a Mr. Potato Head is really about defining the shape of the potato, the form of the buildings, the height of the buildings, how they relate to the street, and architecture can be a supporting component of form-based codes, but so the architecture is on the right-hand side. It's the head and the ears and the eyes, but it doesn't necessarily need to be. It's really up to the community how much of a driving, is there a certain character in the architecture feel that they want, but we shouldn't confuse form-based coding for architectural guidelines or standards. They can be supportive, but it's really about defining the character of the place as you walk down the street.
And we would really like to thank you for finally bringing a slide to our level. We had a hard time understanding all that, you know, gobbledygook you've been trying to.
So,
that we get, okay? Great. So thank you.
You're welcome. So I'm going to actually flip through. Thoroughfare standards become really important because of pedestrian safety. There's a lot of studies that show simply going up 5 or 10 miles per hour dramatically increases the death percentages of an auto car accidents, and so we're thinking very carefully about that. In terms of concluding thoughts, I wanted to throw out items that typically are the tough items that need to be discussed and decisions that need to be made as a form-based coding process moves forward. And I'm just going to throw these out there. There's something that will need to be discussed as the code is drafted. We can discuss them now as you feel is appropriate. The first is parking reductions. And I think your current zoning code update has started to do this, but because you do have transit that's about to happen in your downtown, just thinking really really innovative way about how far parking can be reduced. Can people live within your downtown once the light rail's here without cars, and just sort of making decisions about the worst case scenario is creating what we call auto-dependent density. So dense environments that have a lot of cars and people that rely on those cars. The second is thinking about the level of service policies that you currently have in your downtown. I think right now you have, if I'm understanding this correctly, a level of C policy where a project can't impact a level of service, make it worse than a C in terms of intersection performance. And when we're working in environments like this, what I like to say is all great places have congestion. And so you may want to start thinking about specific areas within your downtown where it's okay to have congestions, because it's a balance between letting cars through and making a comfortable pedestrian environment, for just something to think about. The ultimate size of buildings.
You realize you just stated a, you've just crossed the line into heresy.
Yes.
What's the matter, Mr. Brady? No, we appreciate. All over again, huh? No, we appreciate you hearing that, or not you hearing that, saying that, because that is a big change. And actually, this community has been going through that discussion for certainly the last couple of years, and I think you've seen a change in direction. And not that one is better or worse; it's just that there's different goals we want to accomplish.
Yeah.
And so I appreciate you bringing that up.
I think your old decision to make Main Street one travel lane in each direction really reinforces that. So it's often cities just forget that this policy exists somewhere else, and so once projects start being built, all of a sudden there's an issue with the policy that doesn't meet the objectives of a project that's going in. Ultimate size of buildings, how big or not should buildings be along Main Street and as they transition down. Degree of change desired. We talked a lot about this with stakeholders yesterday. There's three levels of degrees of change we talk about. There's preservation and maintenance, which is obviously important in some areas of Mesa. There's evolution, which is smaller, more incremental change. And then there's transformation. You know, there's areas along the corridor, primarily outside of the main core, where you could convert a strip mall into something much more walkable and urban. So just thinking about that. And then ultimately, what is the character and quality of development that is desired? What is the vision for downtown Mesa? And I just wanted to show a couple of slides, just sort of something to think about. In a climate like this, we come into a context and think about, could a simple concept like courtyards, integrating courtyards into both commercial and residential buildings, be part of Mesa's future identity? Could that be something that differentiates Mesa from other surrounding communities? Using your climate to help identify and create that identity for yourselves. And so we talked a lot yesterday with different groups about Mesa needing to differentiate itself from its competition, both from a residential market standpoint, attracting businesses to your downtown. So what is it that's ultimately going to make somebody decide to move to Mesa as opposed to move to Tempe or to move to Scottsdale? So that's something that just we need to continue to talk about and reinforce in the form-based code. And so just to conclude, we're very thrilled to be here with this, conducting this first public workshop and the workshop with the council as well. This is just the first of two workshops we're going to be having. We're going to be coming back in several months. I've been told after the heat dissipates and holding more of the design-based. We're actually going to be doing more illustrations and sort of the photo simulations as we come back at that next workshop. We'll have drafted large portions of the code at that point. And are just very excited to be here to help you harness the potential that you have and to protect that unique character that Mesa has that everybody is very passionate about. And we've seen all day yesterday in creating your form-based code. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Cavanaugh.
Thank you. A good presentation and timely. Yesterday, I happened to get the conference program for the National Preservation Conference in Austin, and one of the sessions is entitled Form-Based Coding Tools for Sustainable Community Design. And I wanted to follow up on your comment earlier about how that interacts with historic preservation. And I was just curious as to what are some examples of how you would develop or use a form-based code to advance the cause of historic preservation, whether it's buildings or neighborhoods.
Almost every one of our form-based codes has a historic preservation component. Most of our codes focus on downtown and historic neighborhoods. And what we find is the historic preservationists tend to be our biggest allies. They're a little bit anxious at first, but once they find out how the tool can be used to their benefit, they're always really excited about it. And what we found is, like, for an example that I think is fairly applicable in Benicia, California, where we did a downtown Main Street and neighborhood plan, they had a historic residential district in place for the historic neighborhoods, and what they had in place was actually guidelines. But a lot of what was in those guidelines translated directly into what we were going to regulate in the form-based code in terms of trying to preserve the specific character, scale, and form of those neighborhoods. And so we were actually to take a large part of what was in their guidelines, their historic guidelines, and actually integrate it into the form-based code, and they were really excited about that. But then again, there were aspects that were supplemental to the form-based code that remained in historic guidelines. So they very much, historic guidelines or historic overlay, work in unison with the form-based code and definitely achieve the same objective. So we just need to review those carefully to make sure there's no overlap or contradiction between what they're trying to achieve.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you. Councilmember Fender.
Appreciate the presentation. You know what I've seen as a unified theme on this council is trying to be more facilitators and less regulators, and we try to send that message down through the staff. Two questions for you. How does adopting this process and this form-based codes help to achieve that goal? My second question would be, you know, a lot of people talk to us when they're looking at zoning and changes. People want the highest and best use. That's what I think a pretty uniform goal is for everybody. How does this process help or distract from people's private property rights and how they get the best use and the best return for their, you know, property?
I think I can address both of those to start by talking about one of the major goals for a form-based code is creating predictability. And I think there's predictability for the community members, the stakeholders, as well as decision makers in terms of there's a defined vision in place and that code, you know, regulates to that prescribed vision or the ranges that are allowed within that vision. And so there's predictability in terms of what ultimately will get built, but also there's predictability for developers and builders, and just as much so in that they come into a situation and they understand the vision that the community has established and agreed upon and what the intent of the form-based code is, and then they come to the table knowing and having a predictable route. We often say, I've said many times yesterday to different stakeholders and members that came into presentations, is that if a developer comes in and adheres to that community vision, they should really be given sort of the ticket to the express lane to get their entitlement to their project. Let's see, did that answer your question? There was a second part that...
So you're saying, you know, again, the facilitator, the regulator, the highest and best use, predictability and planning. Are there protections in place for current property owners as they go, so we don't make it onerous on them or make it a difficult process if they want to upgrade or go through, you know, going from a regular hard zoning or zoning process that we currently have to more form-based?
Yeah, I think the first thing is just making sure we're carefully considering all those private property rights as we make our way through. That's partly why Tiffany and Bosco's on the team. But also just, there's definitely never going to be a situation where development potential will be reduced within a form-based code area. And so just thinking very carefully about that. And, what we've found is that in the development industry, you know, everybody's talking about mixed use, urban housing opportunities. And so what the form-based code is really doing, one of the primary goals is to remove obstacles that might be in place to allow the developers that are wanting now to do this best practice and development in your community, remove the obstacles, enable them to do a really high quality project that they can bring to the table.
To expand on that, and I mean, we talk about, and I'm going back to your definition here, actually the Form-Based Code Institute, the difference between form-based codes and Euclidean, which is what we currently use now. Euclidean is very much a use-based. It prescribes certain uses and proscribes other uses, and basically it's a limiting in the long run. You know, maybe today it fits in perfect, but 10 years from now, I think one of the big problems we have, and Southern Avenue is a great example, even more so than downtown, although downtown does have the same thing, but Southern Avenue is a graphic example where you have heavy commercial zoning along between Southern Avenue, between Alma School and Dobson, and it's obvious from the massive quantity of empty big boxes that the market does not agree with the zoning. The market is saying that there's a different use for that property than the zoning calls for. And yet legally that use is limited to what the zoning category says, which makes it very difficult for the community to adapt to changes in uses. And not that you do that willy-nilly, but there, you know, things change over time. You know, things that were absolutely appropriate and in sync with what the market was saying 20, 30 years ago are completely out of that. And that's one of our big challenges there along Southern Avenue, is how do we redefine that area and make it work within the legal framework. I'm hoping that what I'm reading here, where we talk about physical form rather than separation of uses being the guiding principle, and if we had, let's assume that we had had form-based codes in place along Southern Avenue, the transition from a heavy big box retail use to other uses, as long as the integrity of the form and the presentation were maintained, would be much easier. And in many ways, to get what Councilmember Fenter said, there is much more flexibility that the property owner has to adapt uses to what this highest and best use is right now. And especially in a downtown area where you have buildings that were used for retail, then office, then a restaurant, and now we're going back full circle to where perhaps residences are the best use, and in the same building on the same site over the last 100 plus years. So am I missing something, or is that am I oversimplifying, or is that really what we believe that form base also brings us?
I think that's a great example, because I think part of another reason we're excited about this project is not only are we creating the form-based code or the form-based zones for downtown, but we're also creating a tool to allow form-based coding ultimately to be applied to other areas of your community. You'll have the kit of parts right to decide where you want to apply it, and that would be a perfect example. That's a pretty typical project for us, to come into a community that has a commercial corridor that's basically the commercial's moved further out or to a different location, and it's frozen in time by zoning, and the form-based code has proven to be an effective tool for transforming those corridors and providing that flexibility as well. Yes.
If there are no, okay. If there are no other questions, we'll just put a plug in for the workshop that's going on today. We have the open studio this afternoon. Remind me of the time, 3 to 5?
Yes.
3 to 5, and then public presentations from 6 to 8. We're at 1240 East Main, the old Mervyn's, transforming into the pool building, so the public's welcome. Encourage any of the council available to come and hear those presentations also.
Great.
3 to 5 is the open studio where they'll be working on some of the concepts and come in, see what they're doing, provide comments, and then the formal presentation starting at 6 this evening.
Yes. Thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay. Item number 2. Hear a presentation and discuss and provide direction on the Desert Uplands area design guidelines. Just change seats, Mr. Wesley?
Just moving around a little bit, stretch the legs.
Okay.
Mayor, Council, this next item has to do with design guidelines that we're starting to develop in the community. As you recall, back last fall and then early part of this year, as you worked on some modifications to the design review process and the role of the design review board, you asked that staff begin to work on design guidelines for different sub-areas of the city, recognizing that there are differences in the city and different characters and different things we would want to try to accomplish, and that by having these guidelines we can give developers and the citizens better understanding, better predictability about what we're looking for, and continue to raise that quality of development in the community. So we've started to do that. We picked the Desert Uplands as a place to start because of the background we already had there with the residential design guidelines, and we thought it would give us a good basis to develop a first set. And so what we're here for this morning is to review these guidelines briefly, but also just kind of the process we've been to and the concepts of where we think we're going through these design guidelines. Since it's a first set of guidelines we've developed, we want to make sure that we're heading in the direction that the council thinks we should be going in. And then we'll come back later if these are looking good to actually get your discussion and action on these particular guidelines. So with that brief introduction, I'm going to turn it over to Laura Heineman, who has been a key staff person working on these, and I'll let her provide the rest of the discussion.
We developed these design guidelines with the Design Review Board, and then we've visited residents in the community and talked to different stakeholders about them. But first, I'd like to talk about our approach to the guidelines in general, and we'd like your feedback about the process. We're taking a look at these guidelines as a way to enhance or maintain the unique characteristics and qualities of different neighborhoods in our community, and so that new development either maintains and is compatible with that existing neighborhood, or directs towards the vision that is envisioned for that area. For instance, in the area where the form-based code is, there's a new vision being developed, so the guidelines would be approaching that vision. We took a look at the we gave you an example of the desert uplands, and you'll notice that we're not prescribing a specific style. We're really encouraging alternatives. The guidelines are written so that staff can interpret them and see if the design conforms to the intent of the guidelines. It's intended to allow people to bring forward alternatives that meet their programmatic needs but still contribute to the character of the area. We are including in these guidelines aspects and features that encourage sustainable development. Our climate is unique, and we'd like to make sure that people are incorporating sustainable elements in there. They will apply to commercial, multi-residence, and employment projects, not single-family. They will accompany the zoning code. The zoning code will provide the requirements. This will just speak to the quality and the characteristics that are unique to that area. Each set of the design guidelines will talk about, the format will be such that it'll indicate what are the appropriate development patterns for that area of the community, what are the open space qualities that are appropriate, connectivity, site development, architectural qualities, and then sustainability. In some cases, these design guidelines will cover large areas. The desert uplands guidelines cover quite a significant area of land. There may be times when it's more appropriate to have a more focused set of design guidelines. Our next set of guidelines will most likely cover the Falcon Field subarea, which is a large area that extends from the northern boundary of the city down to McKellips. And then it's several miles wide. Well, those guidelines will have a specific set of guidelines for just the airport property because there's unique qualities that apply to the airport, and then the remaining design guidelines will relate to those but will be appropriate for off-airport development. We even envision that there could be intersections that are very important, and perhaps we'd like to develop a set of guidelines for an intersection. An example might be Gilbert and Southern, where it has some development opportunities and challenges in that area, and it might benefit from a set of guidelines so the developers know the direction that the city's headed in that area. The format of the guidelines that we develop will be consistent so that developers are familiar with the format and they're easy to understand. They'll cover broad topics first, site design, and followed by more specifics, architectural features and lighting. And then each may contain a section about something that's unique to that area. For instance, in the desert uplands area, we have a section on wireless communication facilities. There has been a lot of discussion about how those look in the desert uplands area, and there's some sensitivity there. So these guidelines provide some direction of what we're looking for in that area that may not be as important in other areas of the city. John explained why we started with the desert uplands. We're interested to get your feedback on how these guidelines read and what you think of them. The desert uplands area is a crescent-shaped area of the city, basically located north and east of the CAP Canal. We are proposing to expand the boundary slightly to Power and McKellips Road so that it will include more commercial, multifamily, and employment properties. The desert uplands area that's defined in the subdivision regulation really covers mostly low-scale residential development, and we're looking for an opportunity to come up with a character that enhances that exists in the desert uplands area. We used the subdivision regulation standards as a base for this document, but we went ahead and expanded it to cover elements that you would find in commercial development. I wanted to give you a few examples of what are part of the design guidelines. We're asking people to preserve natural open space where possible, allowing development to blend harmoniously with adjacent development and with the beautiful desert that exists out there. There is a sense of openness and low-scale development out in that area. We do know that there may be times when people want to build a little height, but we're asking, you know, think about compact footprints so that you can still maintain that sense of openness and views through sites. That's a very important part, aspect of that community. When it comes to architectural features, we're asking that buildings be pedestrian scale and typical of a village as opposed to a big box type approach to building. There are some nice examples out there where developers have taken larger buildings and really subdivided it into smaller sections using shading devices and canopies to break up the massing of the building. We'd like to encourage that as we move forward. Also, as part of the Desert Uplands guidelines, we have plantless. We're encouraging people to use plants that are native to the Sonoran Desert in that area, but then also expanding that list to include some trees that are adapted to the desert that will provide more shade and color when it's appropriate in a commercial development. We wanted to tell you a little bit about the process that we went through to get here. We worked with the Design Review Board to develop a draft document, and then we made that available to the public in a number of different ways. We emailed and we sent postcards and we held a community meeting. And as a result of that, we really did receive some very valuable feedback, and we made some changes to the document as a result of that. People were very interested in the details of the design guidelines, so we added more information about walls and fences, lighting. The plant lists are being reevaluated by landscape architects, and a parking garage came up as one of the features that was going to be part of Parcel 51, so they wanted to make sure we included design guidelines that relate to parking garages and actually encourage people to move them underground. I did have a commercial property owner call me, and he had several good questions that I just wanted to run by you quickly because I think they really are important. He asked whether it was really appropriate to apply these guidelines to new development in these challenging economic times, and our response is that they address environmental and quality aspects of development, and we really felt that it was possible for developers to comply with these guidelines in a number of different ways, and it didn't need to be a burden on them. He asked whether it was appropriate to apply these guidelines to vacant property when it was surrounded by existing development. And when we took a look at the area up there, a lot of things that have been built recently really comply substantially, to some degree to another, to these guidelines. So that, yes, we feel that vacant property that is surrounded by existing development should build to these design guidelines. So we will slowly and continue to move into the direction of stronger desert uplands character in that area. He asked about the impact of these guidelines on small commercial properties. Since these speak to the quality of a development, providing shading devices and landscaping, it really won't affect his buildable area. The footprint will remain the same as is allowed by the zoning code. So we don't think it impacts small commercial property any more than it does large. And then he asked about whether it should apply to property that's on the west side of Power. Currently, we're proposing that the area extend to both the east and west side of Power and north and south side of McKellops. We felt that it did because as you drive through that area or you walk or you travel, you really want to get a sense that you're in a special place. And that means both sides of the street contribute to that character. And by using the center line of a street as a dividing line, we felt that didn't capture that idea of creating a special place that we were looking for. So we're happy to answer any questions that you have, address any comments that you have.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you. Good presentation. I just want to say that I concur with your recommendations on the or your responses to the questions raised by the developer. And also, I just want to note a little bit of the irony of all this, because back in the olden days, when I first came on council, We were confronted with developers blowing off the top of mountains and scraping all the property clean in this area for development. And it was really some far-sighted residents of that area who were really staunch advocates of a different vision for preserving the area and creating a sustainable environment, and asked the councils at that time to adopt the native plant protection ordinance that we had. You would have thought we were committing heresy by raising that issue. And I think the result is this is a positive evolution that really can create a unique and sustainable community there, both residential and commercial uses. And so I think this is a comprehensive vision and approach to a very special area in the city. So I commend your work on this. Thank you.
Councilman Fender.
Did we ever adopt a dark skies ordinance or something that would be incorporated into these design guidelines, the lighting?
Yes.
Mayor, Councilmember Fenter, yes, we have a couple of different standards that have been adopted up there. The boundaries, I think, east of Haas, north of McDowell, in that area in particular, is a very specific set of guidelines for lighting and how it's treated. It's a little bit different than the rest of the community. And there are statements in here generally also about the dark skies and efforts to maintain lower light quality or lower light levels and can't remember the terms, light spillage or whatever, in that area because of the desire by residents in that area to have good night skies.
Councilmember Higgins.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor. I just want to say, yeah, great job on this, and I'm excited about the next one at Falcon Field. So we have a good first step and know how to work through all the issues, I guess. So thank you very much.
Could I ask you a question about, especially as it relates to open spaces and washes and things like that, mm-hmm. how have we integrated open space and leaving things natural with sometimes our engineering demands, which have a different objective? For example, you know, the engineering demands and flood controls sometimes dictate that you not keep a wash natural, which seems to be completely counterproductive. How have we balanced those two?
I think that developers, some more successfully than others, have really taken on the challenge of taking those engineering requirements and applying some design to them, how they handle the sides of those washes, how they handle the bottom of the wash. I think that that will impact, or that does impact subdivisions more because those are larger pieces of land and you have to handle more runoff. But we're mostly what's left in the desert uplands to be developed are smaller parcels. So we might have a wash coming in and simply getting that wash through the site and out again. I don't know that it's going to be that as much of a challenge as it is in some of those residential.
I hope not. And I appreciate the developers of things. I will tell you that sometimes the city is the problem.
Yes.
I can tell you I had a, not in the desert uplands area, but a major fight with the city of Mesa because I wanted to leave an awash natural and they wanted riprap and gunite. And, you know, it was really disappointing that I wanted to leave a natural wash. This is before you, Beth, yeah. So don't worry about it. and it was very frustrating for me to want to leave a natural wash and want engineering to meet standards which created a drainage channel. Big difference. And, you know, when especially when you get into bridges and ADOT standards and things like that, which are completely overkill in some instances. But it seems like to me that there's that we need to really be cognizant of the fact that sometimes there is a conflict there, and it's us that's creating that conflict. And I understand the need for strict engineering standards, and this city has done a wonderful job over the years of engineering things and creating, you know, good functional places because of its standards. And I'm not saying we reduce those, but and maybe you're right. Maybe there's just a very few instances where this will come into play. But I think sometimes we maybe need to be a little bit more open-minded as to how we can adapt engineering standards that will work to help preserve areas rather than relying on the property owner or the developer to meet those standards and be creative. So that's just an editorial comment.
Beth can probably speak to this more.
Beth probably prefers to stay back there and let it lie where it is.
I think we have some successful examples, and it probably is a little bit of heartburn on the developer, but when staff and the developer can get together and just talk about alternatives, and I think I've seen that happen.
With you, I don't really care about the developer or staff because I'm not here to protect developers.
Yeah. Or
I'm here to look at how can we make the desert the nicest place. And this isn't a developer versus city. This is a, we're here for the desert, and we're here for the residents, and we're here for the neighbors who lived up to that. So whether it's a developer or an individual who's a property owner or whatever, I'd like to say that we're just like the form-based codes, we're really working towards standards and objectives. And we need to ask questions, whether it's a developer or the city, mm-hmm. or some other party, whether it's Corps of Engineers, because sometimes the Corps of Engineers is the biggest problem.
Mm-hmm.
If we're all focusing on that objective and working toward that objective, rather than the objective being to build the biggest, nuclear-resistant bridge that we possibly can, which destroys the desert. That's great if our objective is to build bridges that can withstand a 1,000-year flood. But we have to understand that if we do that, we're going to deviate from our objective that you've just very eloquently put here, which is to preserve the desert uplands. And I think we have those conflicts that happen every day. You're right. Now, not so much on as great grand a scale because most of the large parcels are gone up there, but they still happen on a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that as we come into a problem, whether it's transportation, landscaping, engineering, whatever it is, that they're all working toward the same objective. I mean, I thought it was very interesting on the form-based codes. Sometimes congestion is okay. Now, that sounds like total heresy. But if that helps meet a larger objective, which is to create a place, then we might accept that. And in the past, perhaps, we would say we'd have a conflict. We want to create a place, but we also want to attend lane divided road with a median. Those two conflict, and I'm not saying which is right or which is wrong, because sometimes one may be right and the other may be wrong, but we need to decide what is our ultimate objective. And if our ultimate objective in downtown is to create a sense of place, then other things may need to adapt to that objective, and we're not perfect in doing that. And in the past, we've actually not done a great job in doing that because we've allowed what I believe are our secondary objectives or secondary purposes to override the grander objective. That probably makes absolutely no sense to anyone, but
makes a lot of sense.
I think that when we go into like desert uplands, if our intent is to preserve the desert and to create a sense of place up there, everything else becomes subservient to that and needs to adapt to that objective. And that doesn't always happen. So that's all I'd like to say is we need to adapt up to that objective. Just like we're asking owners and developers mm-hmm. and everyone else to adapt to it, the city also needs to do that. And if that comes in engineering standards or transportation requirements or whatever, we at least need to address that issue and recognize that situation exists and that we need to be part of working through that too.
Very good.
Okay, I beat that one to death now. So,
okay.
All righty. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Oh, by the way, I'm going to make another rule. I loved your plant list. From now on, we will always refer to plant names by their botanical name because they really sound cool in Latin. Don't you think?
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, that's the fun part of it is trying to announce them without making it sound really, really weird. Okay, the next item is to approve appointments to boards and committees. In your packet, you have a very, very long list of appointments and reappointments. We actually have 47 appointments that you've been presented. I'd like to commend my chief of staff, Kathy McDonald, who has worked long and hard on trying to match those who are willing to serve with opportunities to serve. Just to give you an idea of the process that she went through, We have asked citizens to volunteer. We've asked council members to submit names. We've asked organizations to submit names and recommendations. And Kathy, in many instances, has interviewed people. In most cases, I think you've talked to almost nearly every one of these, whether an initial appointment or a reappointment. The attempt has been made to try and get a diversity of people, diversity as far as interests, diversity as far as areas of the city. If you don't see your area, your district represented, I will tell you that is not because Kathy has not done her very best to try and get a diversity of interests. It's because there was not a person or persons in the pool from your area. There might have been a name, but perhaps there was somebody who was much more highly qualified or was in a much better position. Kathy then reviewed these names with me. We spent several sessions going over names, trying to accomplish these goals, and that's why you have the final list in front of you. So I just wanted to give you a little background. Kathy, did I miss anything? Okay, thank you. So I presented this list to the council and would ask for a motion to approve these appointments and reappointments to boards and committees. I'm sorry. We have a motion from Councilmember Higgins, a second from Councilmember Kavanaugh. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Hear reports on meetings and conferences attended. Nothing? I will report. Yesterday I had the opportunity to attend as the representative of the City of Mesa, the Valley Hotel and Resorts Association annual luncheon. Councilmember Richens and I attended. And I think it was one of the first times I can remember there were eight mayors who all spoke, which made for a very boring program. I think we put them all to sleep at lunch. No, but we discussed the state of the tourism industry. Obviously, there was a lot of discussion on the impact and effects of Senate Bill 1070. I don't think you can talk about the price of tea in China without discussing that. But it was a very interesting meeting, and it was good to get everyone together and see how our tourism industry, which is a major industry, one of the things that that I found out is in the U.S. Conference of Mayors, Mayor Mufi Hahnemann of Honolulu, whose economy obviously is highly dependent upon on tourism, and who is chairman of the Conference of Mayors Tourism Committee, pointed out something very interesting, and that is that in any state of the union, tourism is either the number one, two, or three industry in that state. And it is a major component of our HEAT initiative. And it's funny that whenever you talk about developing tourism that you get criticized because these are, you know, quote-unquote low-paying jobs that don't do anything. This is a huge industry for us in Arizona, certainly for us in Mesa. It has a significant impact on our economy. And when it impacts our economy, it impacts our citizens because it means jobs. What was really interesting is that at the table that we were sitting, there was about six other people who were significantly impacted by the tourism industry and by hotels in particular, and none of them worked for a hotel. They worked for suppliers. They worked for example, the gal that sat next to me owned a business that provided patio furniture for resorts. And when you think about all the, you know, her business and the pool lounges and things like that, you got a feel for how significant the impact of this industry. And so we think of tourism and we think of the housekeepers in a hotel. We forget about the small businesses and the many employees they have for those who supply hotels, for those who maintain hotels, for those who build hotels. And so I got a good idea and a good feel for just how significant this industry is. And it's hurting. There's no doubt that we were hurting long before the debate about SB 1070 came up. And it's another obstacle we got to get over, and we'll work through it. So I came away from the meeting, however, feeling that you know, long term, we're going to be okay. We're going to do fine. We just got to get over this hump. And we can't obsess with the things are. We just got to work through them. So that was my report. Councilmember Higgins, you went somewhere too.
Yeah, you reminded me of that. Thank you, Mayor. I attended the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry Awards Luncheon yesterday, where one of Mesa's very finest, or Mesa's own, Alan Haywood, received the Volunteer of the Year Award. So it was a lot of fun and a lot of interesting folks.
Congratulations, Alan.
Yes. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else? Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Just remind the Mayor and Council, we have a council meeting, not a study session, a council meeting coming up on Thursday, July 1st. That will be preceded by a Community Neighborhood Services Committee meeting at 3:30. So don't show up here at 7:30 in the morning on Thursday, but we'll have our...
Well, you can come at 7:30 in the morning, but nobody else will be here.
No one else will be here. So that's July 1st, and then the second council meeting in July will be the following Thursday, July 8th. Okay, and then also a reminder, in between that, we have the Friday and Saturday, July 2nd and 3rd, from 6 to 10 p.m. in downtown Mesa is the Arizona Celebration of Freedom. We invite everyone to come down. It's going to be a great event. I think it's going to be pretty amazing for people to see the conversion of what's going to happen in downtown during those 2 days. And then also just a reminder again, the next week we can continue with our zoning code update workshops. District 4 will be Tuesday, June 29th from 6:30 to 8 at the fire station at 830 South Stapley Drive. And then Wednesday for District 3, Wednesday, June 30th from 6:30 to 8 at the Dobson Ranch Casita facility, which is 2719 South Reyes. So invite the residents to come out and participate in those workshops. Thank you.
Thank you. Just one more plug for the Celebration of Freedom. This is going to be pretty exciting. Last count, over 30 businesses and organizations who were co-sponsors, and I'm sorry, 40? More than 40 businesses and organizations who had stepped up to help sponsor, with Southwest Ambulance as the lead sponsor and Cubs. And yesterday, I don't know, maybe it's premature, the Arizona Republic signed on as a co-sponsor. Thank you to the Republic for taking part in a significant way. This is going to be something different and special and unique. So we're excited about what's going to happen in the Celebration of Freedom on Friday and Saturday night, the 2nd and 3rd. Councilmember Fenter.
Mayor, I was just going to tell you, the first time in 26 years, our family has changed our 4th of July plans to be here and go to this, so we're looking forward to something good.
Whoa, that's pressure. Maybe not on me, but on you. Because if we don't make the kids happy, all right. That's great that you've helped us raise the bar. I don't think they'll be disappointed. Tell them to bring their suits and... water zone and the cool zones and lots of food, artists.
No cameras.
I think bring their cameras too. Well, the problem is now it's not bring your camera, just bring your cell phone and you got gobs of cameras. You're not going to find me in a suit. That's a scary thought. Okay. No, but we're excited about it. And remember, pyrotechnics and fireworks in downtown. That's going to be fun. Okay. Ms. Crocker, do we have any requests to speak from the public?
No requests, Mayor.
It's probably just as well. I have a motion from Vice Mayor, a second from Councilmember Higgins. All to adjourn, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much.